Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore. The Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance Conversation Series pairs artists and writers whose work overlaps in a unique way. Join us for a lively conversation between astronomer Lucianne Walkovitz and architect Fred Sharman as they discuss issues surrounding public space planning and planetary systems. Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at Bird in Hand Cafe in Charles Village, 11 East 33rd Street. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
It's Thursday, June 7th, 2018. I'm Dan Rogics of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 397. On the show, another in our series of interviews with candidates for governor of Maryland in the June 26th Democratic primary. Back with us is attorney Jim Shea, the former chairman of Venable, the state's largest law firm, and a former chairman of the state's Board of Regents, overseeing Maryland's public colleges and universities. This time, he brought along his running mate, Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott. So, Brandon, what were you doing when you got a phone call from Jim Shea asking you to be his running mate?
Well, it was a little bit before then. I had known Jim a little bit, and then we had met a few times, actually met with a bunch of the candidates. But then Jim did something unique. As you know, Dan, I spend nights driving around the city, seeing what's going on throughout the city. And Jim reached out to me in January and said he wanted to come and ride with me. It was actually the first time that someone who wasn't an elected official said that he wanted to do that. And that night, I learned a lot about Jim.
Where'd you go?
Everywhere. We went through all 9 police districts. So he spent 2 hours with me. So we started in South Baltimore and Cherry Hill, went through the West Side, and then Emerson Village, made our way up through Park Heights, and then into the Northern District, and over to Northeast, and then to Eastern and Southeast, and then back through downtown to City Hall, where he had met me. And I learned a lot about Jim. I learned that, one, that Jim was someone that really cared about the city. He was comfortable in being uncomfortable and going into places and doing things that he was not accustomed to doing. And I learned that he understood the value of listening to learn and not just having it be about his viewpoint and his way of thinking. And it was a few days after that that he called and asked me to be his lieutenant governor candidate. And I said yes, because this race is about the future of our state and the future of our city.
You must have been a little surprised to be asked to be a running mate for governor. That's not something you were thinking about. Were you being recruited by other candidates?
It's not something I was thinking about, but I knew just through talk that my name had been mentioned for other folks, but it wasn't something that I was setting out to do.
Yeah.
But for me, it's always about when you're in a position like I am, it's not you, it's bigger than you. And me being in this race uplifts conversations, uplifts the city, uplifts things that probably would have not been talked about in this race into the conversation. So it's not just me. I'm representing those people who come from what I like to call forgotten Maryland, no matter if that's here in Baltimore City, if that's in Lexington Park in Southern Maryland, or Suitland in Prince George's County.
So Jim, why did you pick Brandon Scott?
I had met him a number of times had heard about him a lot. Read about him in your newspaper and seen him on TV, and he's a very impressive guy. But we had a couple meetings, and then this drive that he just described. Let me describe it to you from my perspective. So it's the same drive, but two different people. He asked me to meet him at City Hall at 8 p.m. one night. That he drove around the city. He said a lot every night. I didn't want to tell him that 8 p.m. was kind of close to my bedtime. And I didn't. I just said, sure, I'll meet you there. And I did. And he did drive me all around the city. And for once in my life, I kind of kept my mouth shut just to ask questions.
What did he talk about?
And listen.
What did you learn that night?
Oh, he told me about the communities. He told me about the challenges of the communities, the specific problems. He talked about the areas and where there were difficulties and why, and where the police were and how they were supposed to be aligned and how many and where, and that he tried to keep tabs on it, not by spying on them, but by working with them to get a better and more effective police department. A couple things became real obvious to me. One is he knows this city like the back of his hand. All of it. Second, he really cares about the city. And third, maybe most impressive of all, I don't think he talked about himself at all for two and a half hours. He talked about the city and the people of the city, and sometimes a little bit about his family. But it was never bragging. Oh, I'm Brandon Scott, and I'm a city councilman, and I know this person. I'm so used to that in my life. it was striking how dedicated he is to the community. And so I was already, frankly, to offer him because he's got so many skills. But boy, did that seal the deal. And I'll tell you what, every day since then, my respect for him has grown.
It's not like you are unfamiliar with Baltimore. It's not like you're from Montgomery County. I mean, you grew up in Baltimore.
Been here my whole life.
What was the takeaway for you from that night? Not just about him, but about the city.
That there is enormous, almost hidden potential, at least potential that's not obvious to the uninitiated eye like mine. That there were many, many people who were good and earnest and hardworking and needed a chance to be released and sort of given, free rein. But sure, there are some people that we need to handle as a community, but that there were lots of ways of doing that were consistent with people's constitutional rights, with the community's trust, with the need for restorative justice. There's a package here that not only will work if we just apply it, it inevitably works.
Where do you see the potential? What kind of potential?
In the people, in the communities, in the small businesses that are out there, in what the communities want and what they're fighting for, and how important it is for people like me not to go in with preconceived notions and say, well, here's a solution. Mm-hmm. The community knows how to figure out the solutions. What they need is help to achieve them, and not directive help, but supportive help.
So on the campaign trail, your appeal during this period has been directly to Democrats because you're running in the Democratic primary.
We think about those moderate Democrats that voted for Hogan and the minorities and young people that stayed home. Jim and I are the only ticket that can touch all of those people and understand all of those people and relate to all of those people and reunite them. And everyone is responsive to our message because our message carries over. It's about fully investing in public education because we are the wealthiest state in the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, but we've never done that. And we know we haven't done that in areas of concentrated poverty. And that's no different. That's the Eastern Shore here in Baltimore City and Prince George's County and St. Mary's County. That message resonates. Public transportation. We know that the state doesn't have a statewide public transportation plan and that we sit in some of the worst traffic in the United States and that we need to do that we walked away from building a subway line in Baltimore City and that we don't focus in on 21st century transportation. We focus in on adding roads and adding cars, which we know will not solve our problem. We know that we have a very expansive and healthy economy in the state of Maryland, but that growth is only at the top, and everybody wants it for all. But also, again, I think this goes back to the importance of me being in the race, and I don't like to talk about myself, but when folks have to now understand and talk about that, even from the police department in Baltimore being a state agency, right, and not seeing the leadership that should have been shown by this current governor in dealing with that agency and dealing with the issues in the city around crime, waiting literally till the last minute to come in and look like he's coming on the white horse to save us when folks have been asking for some of those very same resources that he offered us for 6 and 7 months ahead of time. People understand that what we need right now is true leadership for this state, and that they understand that if this city is not doing well, our state will not do as well as it can be.
Jim Shea, I wanted to ask you this question because I've asked it of all the Democratic candidates for governor, because I listened to the forums, I listened to the debates, and as we move along, there's some distinctions that are clearer now among the candidates, but you generally all agree on most things. But what distinguishes you and you and Brandon, or just you by yourself first, from the other, six candidates?
Well, I think I have executive skills and experience that none of the others have. And after all, the job of governor is an executive job. Whether you're talking about planning, strategic planning, or investing, or executing, I've done that my whole career and lots of different large organizations. And I think that distinguishes me. That also distinguishes me on the approach to a lot of the issues. how I would do certain things. I think I go about it in a slightly more precise way. But the addition of Brandon can't be underestimated because he does have enormous reach. And together, I think we make a really full package. And where I can see it, we've done a lot of events, many of them fundraising, but not all of them, all through Montgomery County. And I'm here to tell you that the people that come to those events love Brandon. He makes a gigantic hit because we're talking to Marylanders, white and black. Now, these crowds are more white than black, but he's talking to them about issues that matter on a basis that matters in a unifying way that could really do wonders for this state. I mean, the issue of race and age, which we bridge, is extraordinarily important, and people don't know how to get there. They know to get there, you have to be uncomfortable. They don't want to be that uncomfortable, but I'm finding increasingly people are receptive, at least to confronting it and facing that. And I can see that in these crowds, not just in Baltimore, but all across the state.
Do you think people are sympathetic to Baltimore or impatient with Baltimore?
Well,
I mean, people outside of Baltimore.
Yes, I think you
like Montgomery County,
yeah,
like
absolutely.
Wherever you go,
yeah.
Frederick County.
Eastern Shore. Yeah, well, obviously there are people. In fact, I couldn't tell you whether it was a majority or minority, but there is a group of people who are impatient with Baltimore, fed up, don't want to pay for somebody else's problems. But I'm finding increasingly that number is smaller, and the group that would sees the value of helping Baltimore is growing. I don't know whether it's because of the severity of Baltimore's problems or the consequences that are now being visited on them as opposed to thinking it's somebody else's problem. When somebody was telling me, as if I was to sympathize, that they had just traveled and they had said they were from Maryland, and the person overseas said, oh, you mean Baltimore, The Wire. And they didn't like that. They thought that they should be given some level of sympathy, and my feeling was, good.
Mm-hmm.
We're all in this together. And I do think Baltimore is, if it's not the economic driver, it's certainly a major economic driver. It is clearly the cultural capital of Maryland, the entertainment capital. We have so much here that the rest of the state wants that to the extent we're stumbling, it hurts everybody.
What's the governor's role in that? And that's a big question.
Yeah.
But some people would say, well, no, you have a mayor, you have a city council. Brandon yeah. Scott's a member of the city council. That's the city's responsibility. What do you want from the governor?
I want the governor to collaborate, not just with the city leaders, but I want him to collaborate with the community leaders. There's a lot of knowledge and expertise in community-based groups who are not elected officials. They need to be heard from. They need to be checked with. The governor of the state needs to lead the state, lead the people of the state, not particular jurisdictions. That doesn't mean you override the local officials. Of course you don't. You work in concert. But it's pure old-fashioned leadership and consensus building, and that's what distinguishes me. I've done that my whole life.
What would you do specifically for Baltimore? Say you were elected governor, you took the oath in January, and you've got a bunch of things you need to take care of, and over here it says Baltimore. What are your first two or three items?
First, public education. We'll get the Kerwin Commission proposals into the General Assembly ASAP, one of which, of course, is a proper funding formula for particularly for areas of concentrated poverty. So a whole string of things there. Transportation. We lost the red line, and we're now back at the end of a federal queue, which doesn't exist because Trump doesn't have a queue. So we need to try what we can on that front. But meantime, we need some very much improved alternatives. The buses need to be improved. You and I before have talked about Baltimore Link and its failure to provide what we need. So the bus system, rapid bus transit is another thing that could be put in without enormous capital investment. Linking the light rail and the metro, which aren't linked even today after all these years. Extending the metro like we had originally planned to do, up through Hopkins towards Morgan State would bring in more of the city into a unified infrastructure. So all of those things would be early. Stuff in job creation too, but let me jump to the obvious, and that's public safety. You know, the notion here is the governor's job is to blame people when something goes wrong in a city. If it's somebody from juvenile justice is involved in a horrible sequence of the police officer, that's somebody's fault. It's the prosecutor's fault or the judge's fault or somebody's fault, when in fact he runs the juvenile justice system, a state system. It's the wrong attitude anyway. When you have problems, the job of a governor is not to blame people as if he were grading them or thinking about firing them. Accountability means assessing where there are problems and helping those people solve those problems. So you've got all these systems that can help the city in its current state. Parole and probation, which can help get the violent repeat offenders off the street properly handled. Juvenile justice, which can stop this pipeline that we've got, school to prison. The correction system itself is also a state system where we've got to have much more in the way of restorative justice. And then the Maryland State Police can help with the personnel manpower issues to the extent they exist. And then finally, the Baltimore State Police, as my friend Brandon likes to point out, is a state agency, and he is a city councilman. If he wants to reduce the size of the police district, he has to go to Annapolis to get that done. And that it's we're the only jurisdiction, I think, anywhere. I don't know of any other big city, and there's certainly no other jurisdiction in Maryland that doesn't have its own police force.
Yeah, I think it comes down to actually being a leader. And are you going to be a leader, or are you going to hold press conference to make it look like you're doing something? And that's what we have had this during Governor Hogan's term. When you think about that, for example, the unfortunate incident that happened with the young man and officer in Baltimore County, where we know DJS dropped the ball. We know that DJS dropped the ball. Well, we used to have this thing called the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. And remember, last year he decided to cut the funding to the Criminal Justice Court.
The governor disbanded it.
Disbanded it. Yeah. Wouldn't allow me into a meeting to talk about crime in Baltimore, and then goes out and consistently holds press conferences, says that the mayor and city council aren't doing anything about crime in Baltimore. We need leadership, and where the governor can be, one, the police department is a state agency. It should be a local agency. We are the only city council in the nation that doesn't have that authority. But seeing that it is a state agency, the governor can be helping to hold them accountable. The governor can be placing and helping us with that legislation in Annapolis. We did not hear the last two years from the governor's office about the policing bills that we had and to redraw the district lines, even though the police commissioner himself supported it in Annapolis. That's what we need. We need leadership from the governor. We know that the school system is another perfect example. The state took over school system when I was in seventh grade at Roland Park Elementary Middle. But the governor has been hands-off and saying, it's the city's responsibility, the city's responsibility. No, these children are your children, too, and you need to be the governor for all. You can't make it out just because it's politically beneficial to you or for him to make it look like the city's incompetent and that he has nothing to do with it. The reality is he is the governor of Maryland, and that includes the city of Baltimore, specifically when it comes around education and public safety, because the state has so much power.
On transportation, Jim alluded to the red line, and he said we've got to make another go at getting the funding for that. You know, because of Hogan's decision, the state is out $964 million, nearly $1 billion in federal funds. Is it even worth the time to?
I think that you have to try, but we also have to understand that that's a long-term goal. We need to focus on what we can also
It's a long shot.
Long-term goal, right? We have Trump in office. There's no federal crew. Who walks away from $1 billion? They could have considered alternatives. I remember a meeting where Senator Murkowski said to them, hey, if you guys tell us you're going to consider serious alternatives, we may be able to hold the money. They immediately said that they would not do that, right? Those are the things that we have to do. But we do have to look at bus rapid transit. Look at what we could do at bus rapid transit from east and west on North Avenue. That would be changing for the city of Baltimore. Like Jim said, trying to figure out if we can get funding to continue the existing metro out to Morgan State and out to that side of the county as it was originally intended. Looking at investing in other kinds of transportation throughout the city of Baltimore, even down to bikes, making public transportation attractive to people. That's what we can do. And we know when people are in East and West Baltimore, as Jim found out when he tried to take the bus from Sandtown to the Amazon warehouse, they can't get to work. So you can't say, oh, these people don't want to work, when they do, and you don't provide the basic transportation needs to get them there.
How do you respond to this person? So I'll play a role here. I'm a Baltimore County, say maybe Harford County Democrat, and I voted for Larry Hogan last time. Seems like a nice guy. He's a Republican. We've got a Democratic legislature. Maybe that's a good balance. He cut my highway tolls on 95. He seems like a good guy. Why should I change?
Well, I think what you're saying is what I hear so often. You ask people whether they approve of Larry Hogan, and fundamentally their answer is, yeah, I approve. He hasn't done that much harm. And that, I think, reflects the low level to which we have had our elected officials drop, that that's the standard that we're holding him to, and we'll never achieve our potential. We'll never improve, much less achieve our potential. What you're talking about is treading water when you're talking about tolls being reduced or lanes being added, at best treading water. And, you know, with some direct and sensible and wise and not overly expensive investments, we can do so much better. On transportation alone, this doesn't cost a nickel, but it would make things much better. If we had a plan, a statewide transportation plan, then when we did improvements, little roads here and there, they would actually fit in and ultimately someday make a whole. We don't have a plan, so we build roads to nowhere or roads halfway to nowhere.
Or we widen roads that don't really need widening.
Right. Or if they do, what happens there is you widen them, and for a little bit of time, you have less congestion. But with the demand increased, you go back to the same congestion, just more cars. But the plan, we need the plan so that as we build, it's going to take a long time to build a great metro infrastructure just in Baltimore, much less connect it with Washington, much less make sure that that metro metropolitan area is well served. So, but if we have a plan, each time we do something, we're building something that's coherent and doable. The other important part of a plan is if it truly is statewide, everybody can see where they benefit from it, where they fit in. And you don't have, as I saw this summer when I was out in Salisbury, somebody said, well, why do I care about the red line? If I could have said, well, look, this is part of a statewide plan. If we can do all of this, we're going to connect up the state in a really robust way. Commerce will flow. The economy out here will be much better. You'll be able to get in and out of the Eastern Shore more easily. They see the part in it, and you have I'm not trying to be Pollyanna. It's still going to be tough, and there'll still be interjurisdictional fights. But you have a shot then. You've got people on the same page. Dan, this state is too small to be broken up in the parochial little sections that we are, and we're hurting ourselves every day when we do that.
When folks say Larry Hogan, he hasn't done any harm, the immediate response for me is, well, what good has he done? He hasn't done any good for the average Marylander. Yes, and also this choice about this next governor is about not just right now. We have to get out of this business of electing elected officials so that they can help me in the next 4 years. But what about your children? What about your grandchildren? What about when you're old enough to retire? That's what this election should be about. And when you think about the things that this governor has done, even with reducing the tolls and reducing the revenue that goes into that fund, well, that person in a few years from now is going to be calling their local city or county council person and saying, why hasn't this street been repaved? And then they won't even think that, hey, the revenue comes from the tolls. But this election, really, what we need right now, Dan, more than anything, are elected officials who are unafraid to be unelected. And they're doing that by focusing in on the issues, not that will get them reelected, but that will benefit their state and the people that live in their state, their city, their country, for long after they're elected. That's why Jim and I are different from the other tickets, because we want to fully invest in public education. We know that we're not going to be able to declare victory in our term and say, yes, we fixed education in Maryland. You look at Massachusetts, they did it in 1984, and they stuck with it. And now, 34 years later, 1984 was a good year, the year I was born. 34 years later, they're number one in education, the only system competing on the worldwide scale, and they're number one in economic development. Public transportation is the same thing. We know that we're not going to be able to go out here and say, yes, we fix public transportation in Maryland. But if we start the work, if we set out the plan and the state sticks to it, 15, 20 years from now, we'll be much better for it. And that's what we should really be doing. That's what we should be electing our elected officials for. And in the face of Donald Trump, We need a governor who's going to stand up, not be silent, not bend over, not just say, oh, well, I can pick this fight with him, but not that fight. Every time this president says something wrong or does some policy that's going to hurt the state of Maryland, we need a governor that stands up.
Park Heights and Pimlico. You know, we just came away from the Preakness. We have the Belmont coming up this weekend, so I thought I would ask you about this. What would you be doing about this? On Preakness Day, we had the COO of Stronach Company, kind of a grim outlook for the Preakness staying in Baltimore. I mean, that racetrack has been sitting there idle for most of the year, for several years now. To me, it just seems like there's so much potential there, and the history and the cultural connection of Baltimore to racing, to Maryland racing. The Preakness needs to stay. I mean, that's my personal view.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't yours, but as governor, what would you be doing?
You know, it is my view, but there's a bigger issue, as you suggest. Not only the heritage of racing in part of Baltimore, that's really important, but we need to knit that in with that community there, because that's
Park
also
Heights.
Park Heights. Yeah. That's also going on. That community has deteriorated. And when you think about it, it's sort of going hand in glove on that. It's not one problem and then another. It's the two problems together. So what I would do is I would work hard at a redevelopment plan for the entire area that would include Pimlico. Now, I know that's been tried, but trying is not doing. And I would appoint some really good real estate development people to take a hard look at what we can do with what ultimately could be a fantastic neighborhood, mixed income, redevelopment around that racetrack and its history. And we can make it all good. We're not going to be able to save a little oasis of the Preakness. And frankly, I'm not sure we want to. I think we need to have the whole area be redeveloped.
Yeah, as you know, Park Heights is a place near and dear to me. I grew up there, right. Actually. In 2016, one of my best friends growing up, little brother, was killed 400 feet away from the racetrack, right there on Queensbury and Spaulding Avenue. And for me, we know that how much the Preakness means, and we have to do everything that Jim said, and we have the Park Heights Master Plan. You have Park Heights Renaissance, who's been working hard to trying to generate redevelopment. We're just able to demolish a lot of the vacant homes, but we have not had the investment in the state step up to be a big partner and say this is a priority for the governor of Maryland to not just rebuild this neighborhood to bring in new people, but to rebuild this neighborhood for the people that have stayed, like my grandmother, like everybody else in my family outside of me and my brother who live in Northeast Baltimore. We have to rebuild that community person by person, block by block, building by building. And that's a tough thing to do. But what we cannot do is what we have been doing is thinking that we're going to come in, save it, knock a bunch of buildings down, and just say we declare victory, we got rid of blight. No, because when you knock those buildings down, you think about the people that used to be there that are no longer there, but also the people that still that live there, that have to deal with their blighted community every day, they have to deal with the violence that exists in that community every day. We have to invest in the entire community of Park Heights, and that includes the people, and I can't say that enough.
You've been campaigning for a while now, Jim, and then Brandon joined you a few months ago. I wondered, in campaigning and going to candidates' forums or just fundraisers, talking to people, was there an issue that came up, not just one person bringing up, maybe a few people brought it up, that you either weren't thinking about or didn't think of as a priority? And what did you learn from the campaigns?
I have been doing it for a little over a year, and we're in the home stretch, and it's like a fire hose that I'm trying to drink from here. And so it's very hard for me at this instant to pick out one issue that jumps out at me. I think what's clear to me is there are a whole network of problems, whether it's public education, transportation, economic development, public safety, environment, housing, that in a way are interrelated. You can't really fix one without fixing the other. You could get a whole bunch of new jobs to come in here, but if you haven't educated all the folks here, they're not going to get the jobs. And it happens in some cities. You see then the hiring coming from outside the area, which you don't want. We just talked about it. You can redevelop Park Heights, and if you do it by imposing on the neighborhood, you haven't helped that neighborhood, you've displaced it with gentrification, which we don't want. So I think, struck by the interrelationship between all of these problems. And if you had to pick a core, you'd probably say public education. But that alone isn't going to do it. You got to go at it with a full plan and with really good people. Really good people. And that's when you start with the lieutenant governor. But we would recruit really good agency heads from all over, diverse, effective people. I've done that my whole life, too. That's what we need. It's an all-in effort.
Did you have anything to share from the campaign, Brent?
Yeah. I think is that we all have the issues that are here in the city are everywhere. And they're growing throughout the state. When you talk about the amount of children now entering Montgomery County schools not ready to learn at pre-K and kindergarten levels, the amount of children entering their schools that are in poverty, when you talk about the transportation issues in St. Mary's County that they're having because of the growth that they're having, we all have the same issues. And I think now more than ever, people are realizing that we need to fight for these issues together and make them a priority together as a state, not just one county versus another, because we all are going to continue to have them if we continue to fight separately for the same cause.
Dan, if I could add to that, you know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, that's going to be real expensive or it's going to take a really long time. And my reaction to that now is it's not getting any cheaper and it's not going to happen any sooner. Problems aren't going to go away on their own. We better get at it right now.
Jim and Brandon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Shea and Brandon Scott are running together for the Democratic nomination for governor and lieutenant governor in the Maryland primary election on June 26th. Jim Shea, who is 65, was for many years chairman of Venable, the state's largest law firm. He's also a former chairman of the state's Board of Regents, overseeing Maryland's public colleges and universities. He once chaired the Empower Baltimore Management Corporation, which provided job training and money to small businesses in East and West Baltimore. Brandon Scott, 34 years old, is a member of the Baltimore City Council and chairman of the council's Public Safety Committee. You can hear an earlier conversation with Jim Shea and learn more about him from Roughly Speaking, episode 283, that was recorded late last summer. You can find a link to it in the notes with this podcast. You can listen to my interviews with all the candidates for governor in the Roughly Speaking archives. There will be more conversations with candidates in the next 2 weeks. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast. If you get a chance, review it on your Apple Podcast app or for Android users on Stitcher. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes producer and journalist Cyrus Farivar to discuss his new book, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech, an insightful look at the implications for the future of privacy. Tuesday, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.